what do you have for us today, Brian?
Well, a few observations. The first thing I would want to talk about is kind of a shed some light on current events. I was just, rather than go straight to McLuhan, I'm going to start with you. I was just reading, actually I just finished reading the book Cryptoscatology, which is a book by Robert Guffey.
Yes.
And he cites you a few different places in the book, but then you show up more at length in this story in the last chapter where he, it's funny, he calls them the willow trees because it's the evergreens, but you apparently consulted with the evergreens for a particular case he was looking into and then advised him, he says, to not say the name or something. But so that's interesting. And then at the end, he sums up the book by saying, I've laid out all these archetypes, and then he refers to you as the trickster. So that's nice. But and a particular thing in there that kind of caught my eye right near the end, it's the book is Cryptoscatology, Conspiracy Theory as Art Form. And, you know, it's always nice to read conspiracy-themed stuff from people who are very familiar with McLuhan and who are bringing up McLuhan repeatedly. And he, near the end of the book, he mentioned the principle, the formal cause principle, where the audience is basically the formal cause of any particular piece of art, and that the audience helps create it. And then he says that the audience, and then he's saying this is as true for conspiracy theory as anything else, but then he refers to the audience not so much as fellow researchers and people reading the books or consuming the media and trying to learn about things, but he refers to the audience as being the conspirators or perpetrators of these kinds of acts, and refers to it kind of in a... He compares it to an art forger who, you know, they have to efface their own participation, but they still want, they still crave the recognition and maybe have a perverse need for that or something. And so it's an interesting idea, the audience for conspiracy theory being the conspirators rather than who you would think to be the audience. And I think there's kind of a converse principle where you might assume that the conspiracy theory researchers and people who are all aware of things are not so much the audience events like a parapolitical or conspiracy events like something like September 11th or whatever. You'd think that the audience for the events like this are the masses and the normal people, the people who are going to take it at face value, the people who are going to read that text or experience that event in the way it's intended, rather than the people who are going to take a more realistic seeing through it kind of view. But then again, I think you could just as easily view it that that the conspiracy theorists are the intended audience of a lot of these things, especially in an intimidation kind of way, like, because a lot of times a recurring theme ever since September 11th has been this thing where people will remark about how they don't even seem to be doing a very good job of hiding it or something, or this is an unnecessarily obvious detail, and that kind of thing really does have a strong intimidation effect upon the kind of researcher community, because you would think, you want to have this naive thought that, well, I mean, if we could just get the word out about this fact to everybody, then, you know, they, like, if only people could see through it and pay the right kind of attention to it, then, you know, the problem would be solved. But then you have to be faced with this fact that, like, no, it's kind of obvious on the face of it, and you get this feeling that they're laughing in your face, like, ha-ha, look, we don't even need to try. But I was thinking about these themes in particularly with this very, very, like, just in the past week thing that came up that I need to just, it's very quick, I'll just share it about this shooting that happened in Ottawa.
Yeah.
There was a very strange lie told about this on the the state broadcaster, the CBC. They had a news program where they were saying, and you can see it on YouTube, it's you can search for it on YouTube, it's how Kevin Vickers subdued the gunman. And so they're sensibly they're describing to you, like, okay, we've done our reports and figured that we've done our research and this is what happened inside the Parliament buildings. And it's strange because the report begins with they're using Google Street View, because it's not just Street View. The Google Street View does also go inside the Parliament buildings. And they start off illustrating it with they use Google Street View to take you from just inside the doors down the hall to this alcove where the final shootout supposedly took place. And they use Street View to take you all the way to the alcove. And he points out, he says, and there's the alcove where he tucks himself in there, and that's where the shootout took place. And then they switch to photos and TV footage from that day for a couple of minutes. And then he says, now, if you were to be, he says, now, just to give you an idea of just how many rounds were expended and just how many bullets were fired, here's how it would look, here's how it looks today. And then they show you a photo of the wall of this alcove, and sure enough, there are all these holes in the wall, and they have arrows pointing to them, and he's saying, there are fully 9 bullet holes here in this wall. But the thing is, if you go onto Street View, those holes were already in the wall.
Mm-hmm.
And they took Street View right up to the alcove on the TV thing, and then switched off to something else and then to a photo, which I'm sure the photo was taken that day, but they're trying to tell us that all these holes in the wall were just made there last week or 2 weeks ago when the shootout took place, but Google Street View went through there back in the spring of 2013 and all those holes were already in the wall. And so it would be, at first glance, you're just like, oh, my God, what a terrible lie, or, okay, maybe it's a mistake. No, that couldn't be an honest mistake. What? Those holes were already in the wall, and it's on Google Street View. You know, at first you just think, what a terrible lie. But then I really can't shake this thing about how they started off with Google Street View and brought you right up to the alcove. So there's no, they're underlining Google Street View, and there's no way that the people involved in the show didn't make, like, you're literally, they bring you up to one click away from turning and seeing those holes on the wall. So in a way, it's almost like that kind of intimidation tactic or something of being so blatant that I was talking about, but yeah. More importantly, it speaks to the idea of that the audience for conspiracy theory research stuff is the conspirators themselves, because it almost seems more like a fishing expedition of, like, if we put something this blatant out there, who will react to it? What will they say? How extreme will they be? How, if there's something that's this obvious and provable and doesn't rely on conjecture or anything, how far will that spread across the Facebook webs of Canadian society with people being outraged? It seems more like a research probe, and particularly with the how extremely will people react to it, you know? Like, some people, out of people who notice this lie we told or this discrepancy, what people will say just, oh, wow, that's a real discrepancy. Could that have been an honest mistake? I don't know. Versus the people who are like, the presenter should be behind bars for the rest of his life. This is proof we're at war, people. You know, like, it's like a research probe that they're doing to gauge reactions, because it's not convincing.
Brian, it's also the faction that shot the other faction, because the factions know there's a conspiracy going on between each other. They're celebrating right in front of the other faction that lost. So it might be targeted at the faction that lost in that shootout.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it was a previous shootout that no one reported.
Yeah, exactly. What's the story on how those things really got there? It's kind of ominous, too.
Okay, I want to mention a couple of points you brought up. This book by Robert Guffey is him processing me, trying to figure me out. Remember, he's the one who wrote that brilliant article in Paranoia Magazine, Winter 2013, 2000, issue number 22, saying that The Matrix is about me. And then we went on to have good friendship dialogue for many years. And then he did another article, follow-up interview with me about the third Matrix, which I had predicted it would have to end that way, that it did, blah, blah, blah. So then Robert, he became an editor of a poetry book or something at Long Beach College. And he wrote a story, and it might be the one in the book there, and he mentions the Evergreens helping this FBI friend of theirs, you know, that had been killed. And I told him, look, you can never talk about that. Michael asked me, Michael Blake Reed said, do not tell anybody this. And he went ahead and did. Either he forgot or I don't know what he did. When I asked him about
In the book, he says you told him not to talk about it. So he changed the name of, he didn't say the name Michael Blake Reed. He changed the name to
the Willow.
To something and then called them the Willow Trees,
Right, there is an actual spin-off from the Evergreens called the Willows. But the thing is, he did publish it somewhere else, I think. I mean, I remember seeing it, unless I read it wrong, because I have a copy of that book you're talking about. No, not, I have a copy of the poetry book that he did for the college. And maybe in there is where he made the mistake, so then he put it in this new text that he put out. And So because I thought that he had betrayed me and that, he got upset and he never talked to me again because I guess I embarrassed him or humiliated him. It was just between me and him, but he did not like me chiding him. So he couldn't keep the story back, so he just changed the name. Anyway, since I haven't talked to him in years, that's about 8 years ago, 9 years ago, I haven't heard much about what he's doing, but that book, when he, that book that he finally put out, is him trying to figure out whether I'm real or not, and using me as a metaphor for the metaphor of conspiracy and all the McLuhan quotes and everything he got from me. There's an interview with him. Jerry Fialka interviews him in the past year, and you could hear that, and they make some snarky remarks about me. So that is where Robert has left himself, sitting in the old 20th century and missing the ionic new levels, which he could profit from. But apparently he got married and had a kid and got a mortgage, so he had to sober up. That's the background to that story. Now, here's the Xenocrony, and you're the expert of the Xenocrony between me and the Church of Subgenius. Well, I was in Germany from August 4th to August 11th in Berlin with Roxana. And we have all kinds of videos of that. Well, it turned out a week later, Reverend Ivan Stang and Princess Wei were invited to Leipzig. And they spent a week or so, I guess, in Leipzig. And he talks about it on one of his recent shows. And he also does what I did in Berlin, went to, goes to museums and this and that. But he also meets someone called The Large, somebody who does mashups for the Church of the Subgenius show, our Slack. And we know that Ion describes JW as not a medium but a large. So here you have this literal paralleling of me by staying, you know, a week later. Ends up, he doesn't know why he's in Germany. So some strangers invited them. They hardly knew him. And so they went. And so I'd like to play here a little couple of minutes of them talking about this. And think of this anachrony with Bob goes to Berlin, to Germany, and then he has to go. Right, a week later, including his birthday, August 21st. So let's see if this works here. Got the sound up. It should come through. Oh, I just want to say, so this music we're hearing is a collage of something done by The Large, and then he's going to go into it. Edited by The Large. Sure.
Oh, yes, dear friends, that collage was by The Large, who is here with us despite this wind in Leipzig.
Leipzig.
You pronounce it all wrong, man.
I'm deaf.
You never got. No, lips. It has nothing to do with it. You're just plain stupid, man.
That may be true. We didn't call it the Church of the Genius. Well, we're here with Reverend Tanya, Reverend Bucky Argyle. Our hosts here and our guides know the language and the way around. They know everything worth knowing, and the large knows everything else.
He knows, says the large knows everything else, like Ion.
Right.
So that's an interesting point.
Yeah,
here.
I like that.
Yeah.
No.
Okay, carrying on.
Sunny walk on a rainy, sunny day.
This is one of those primitive cities where the cars aren't allowed.
This ancient cemetery we're sitting in is, well, it's older than the ones we walk through in Cleveland.
Mm-hmm.
There's guys here that were born in 1790 and died in 1950. I don't get that. It must be all the healthy food, all the good cheese. The large said he only came here for the cheese. That's all he wanted. And it's the only reason he goes to Holland, not for the pot, for the,
for
cheese.
The cheese.
Yeah.
It's so good.
So we've been here, oh, what, less than a week. I said, hey, it's Thursday. Oh, it's my birthday.
Yeah.
I turned 161 today. And we're going to go eat at a really fancy restaurant called the Auerbach Keller. Which is our box
cellar,
and it's 400 years old. Although I'm sure they've replaced some of the plates and silverware and stuff.
Probably.
There's going to be some kind of a subgenius party later in the week on Saturday night. We're expecting at least four people besides us, Bucky and Reverend Tatiana. Reverend Tatiana is German and Russian. And she sounds really sexy when she talks German.
She sounds really sexy when she talks in any language.
Yeah. and Reverend Bucky is from Austin, Texas, pretty much. So he and I are the dumbasses and accompanying royalty.
A side note there, Robert of Tottenham introduced me to Bucky back in 2008 in London, who was the ambassador of the Republic of Texas to London, you know, some separatists. So there, you've got this Bucky from Austin, Texas. And I actually was in Austin, Texas in 1971 in the spring visiting some people associated with cosmic awareness, and that was the spring, summer when Stang went to the University of Texas in Austin. So, and he years later said Firesign Theater was one of his favorite groups back then. And that's why I remember being in Austin, Texas at one of the parties. They played a lot of Firesign Theater that spring, May 71. So I was tuned into Stang's reality before I met him 7 years later. So that's an interesting point. Now back to this dialogue.
Walk around Germany here.
But now Bucky is from Leipzig.
Yeah, I guess so. He must have a green card and everything else.
He's trying to be from Leipzig.
Yeah. This town is about as big as Cleveland. It's the 12th largest city in Germany, which I think Cleveland is now about the 12th largest city in the U.S. And it used to be an industrial center that was really rich but really polluted, just like Cleveland. Then the industry collapsed, just like Cleveland. And also, it was, unlike Cleveland, it was under communist rule for a long time, and it went to hell. But around 1989, all that changed, and it's been dressed up like Cleveland and fixed up a lot since then, and it's full of great museums. We went to the Anthropology Museum inside the Grassi Museum, which isn't really very grassy at all.
No.
And only made it about halfway through before it closed. And then we went to the Art Museum and saw Flemish and Dutch masters and stuff from the 15th and 16th century, back when people knew how to draw and paint everything except babies. We must have seen a million baby Jesus in paintings yesterday that were all crappy. They could paint women and men and tortured Jesuses. We must have seen 100 90 tortured Jesuses.
Easily.
Yesterday. But there were that many baby Jesuses, and they were all deformed, every single one of them, just scary looking.
They kind of, a lot of them looked like a bean with arms and legs attached.
Yeah, really hideous. And then there were the baby heads flying around with little wings in some of the paintings.
Well, the angel bugs.
Yeah. So we have a lot more museums to go see.
It was really impressive. It was immense. The ceilings in that place were like three stories high.
Well, that's art museums for you. They're a big waste of space, if you ask me.
Oh.
And especially the modern art section with all the splatter crap, Jasper Johns type garbage.
It wasn't garbage. I liked that stuff.
Garbage. That stuff, anybody, kid can do that. But I can't say that I could do a hideously deformed baby any better than those Dutch masters. Or a tortured Jesus. Man, there's a lot of tortured Jesus in there.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a pretty Christian town, considering that they were under communism for a long time, and the commies dynamited the big church at the university. It's since been replaced by a much bigger and more obnoxious church, as if to say, screw you, Ruskies. You know, we could drive to Russia from here. In fact, we could drive to Beijing from here. You drive just about, I think you could drive to South Africa from here if you took a ferry at one point. Oh, it's interesting. My feet hurt again. God, my feet hurt.
Such a walkable city. That's why your feet hurt. We've been walking and walking and walking. We didn't have to walk up the, how many stairs? 500 stairs?
Yeah, and the new rat house, which is not where they keep the new rats, but the new town hall or city hall.
Where they ratify laws.
There's a high tower that we tried to get into today, but we were late. We have to go back at 14 o'clock or blow it off. That's in a little while.
40 minutes, right.
Yeah, but this cemetery is peaceful and incredibly ancient. You can't really read most of the inscriptions because they've been worn away. Except for the really rich guys. They got marble inscriptions instead of stone or concrete or whatever they're using here.
Sandstone, it looks like.
Yeah, so whatever erodes the fastest. Yeah, it's funny to walk around a place that has a building, like an old hotel that Peter the Great stayed in, right next to a Woolworths. And a Burger King across from the Thomas Kirche, where Johann Sebastian Bach played and ran things for 20 years.
He was the cantor.
Yeah, everything's all Bach-y around there. And in fact, to make it really sound like Leipzig, we'd have to mix in some background street band playing Bach or Schiller or something.
Or jazz or
Mendelssohn. Mendelssohn lived here. Richard Wagner was born here, but he didn't like it. And he had nothing good to say about his childhood home of Leipzig.
It's similar to New Orleans in that you hear every style of music as you're walking down the street. Sometimes classical, but and at St. Thomas Kirche, of course, yes.
Well, there's a lot of oompa music, yes, too. You hear a certain amount of oompa stuff, it being Germany and all. So, well, I guess that is our testimony for now. It's only 13:20 in the afternoon. See, I'm starting to get the hang of this foreign time telling.
Foreign slash.
Yeah, next I'll be measuring things in centimeters and kilometers.
And degrees in Celsius.
I haven't mastered that one yet. Converting euros to dollars in my head has been kind of fun. The cup of coffee was only about $1.50, and the Bockwurst was about $2.20, something like that. But this is actually a pretty cheap town if you stay out of the really
fancy restaurants, yeah,
which we're going to go to tonight. And have lamb. No, lamb is at the hookah bar that we're going to on Saturday.
The subgenius party.
Yeah. Okay. 6-2 and even. Over and out.
Okay, Brian. I find that a pretty good xenocrony there. Much like my life. But the week before in Germany. Though I went to a better city, bigger city, and had a better host than Flapdoodle from Russia. You know, he does play their meeting.
But everything was better.
Yeah. Everything was better in my trip. But they had, I think they just got zapped over there by the constant shadow they have to be in connection to me. If I do it, they got to do it. You know, and they don't even know they're doing me. Maybe a subgenius will be hearing the show and I'll pass the word on to them. So now let's go into your points of McCloom Books. Which book do you want to go into right now?
Well, a very interesting little note that I never got around to before in the Nova Express was one of the things I was really disappointed seeing the list of books. I was really hoping there would maybe be one or a few Wilhelm Reich books in his library. You know, I'd really like to know what he thought of Reich, especially not just because, you know, not just a psychological sense, but because Reich then branched into physics, and that's a pretty important subject for getting the gist of just how deep and powerful the whole McLuhan percepts go. Like, as you put it in one of your essays, you said that physics has always only been describing our social situations. And you know, Croker says something about that resonantly somewhere, or similarly to in physics, where with dark matter, it seems like most of the matter in the universe has just disappeared. He says that similarly in sociology, most of society and culture or whatever and people have just disappeared and no one knows where they've gone.
Most of all sociologists, he says, don't know that it's society has disappeared. That's what he says. Let me add to this. I'm reading, I bought some of Don Thiel's archive, and so I have his manuscript for the big thesis, post-McLuhan thesis, that never got published, called The Ecology of Sense. And he talks a lot about Wilhelm Reich in this, especially Maya Vevsky's movie, W.R., the something of the Mysteries of the Organism, this Yugoslavian filmmaker that Don Thiel made a lot out of. Maya Vevsky, I think it is. And so it's about Reich, W.R., Wilhelm Reich, and Mysteries of the Organism. And it's a very multi-level movie, and Don Thiel relates it to Finnegan's Wake and everybody, a lot of good stuff. But it's funny, I was thinking about Reich the last few days while reading this manuscript, and it was on your mind, too.
Yeah, the first thing on my mind, McLuhan-wise, anyway, I wanted to bring up. Because, I mean, I would have, if I had to guess what McLuhan would have said about Reich, you know, because with the, biology as well, but physics, in the physics sense, you know, it's interesting to think of the normal way of thinking is that, like, yes, of course, we have a very different paradigm these days, but it's based on our progressing understanding, and we have some advancing, like, even if it's a paradigm shift, it still represents we're getting closer or deeper into the reality. But it would probably help people's perception a lot if instead of calling it quantum physics, they called it electric physics. Because the truth is, this is the physics that we came up with by using electric tools to discover things.
That's right.
And, you know, whereas Newtonian physics is the kind of physics that one Galileo can figure out in their attic with rolling balls down a plane or abstractly on a piece of paper.
And kinetic physics.
Electric machines going, then
it's kinetic. It's kinetic physics with Newton and visually biased, and then overlaying the beginning of industry with kinetic spaces, and that's F equals ma, and then the Galileo stuff, right? Totally fits. And so then
the whole center margin planetary orbits thing I was talking about 2 weeks ago.
Yes. And so what's the ground of string theory, which the old quantum physicists say, this is outrageous that that string theory is taking over. They don't even do experiments.
Yeah.
They just make up shit. But the thing is, it's based on an acoustic ground. String theory has an acoustic resonance to it, to the degree I understand it. And that means that the acoustic spaces become figure in the tactile ground. So the the internet is, you know, hyper-tactilely squared. So at least they're going to come up with acoustic space as a figure. Just as
In physics, all sorts of things are being questioned these days. There's stuff coming out about, is gravity an illusion? And the big idea is not so much parallel worlds, but are we living in some kind of hologram? You're getting a very, like, the idea of a computer-ish kind of ground is starting to become a figure that way.
And
but
so,
I would have figured...
Go ahead.
Yeah,
no,
I would have figured that... I would have figured that McLuhan's brief take, anyway, on Reich would have had something to do with it being a kind of a satellite physics, in the sense that when the satellite goes around the entire planet and then puts nature inside an environment and nature has been obsolesced, then life itself would become a figure. That would be McLuhan's reaction to the orgone.
It would become archetypal.
The orgone.
The basic process of the chemical body become archetypal, like the orgasm for Wilhelm Reich. And he said, everything is bent dependent on the orgasm, you know?
Right.
And then the sex part of it, in general, would be the kinetic bias of his Americanism, though I think he was European originally and a student of follower of Freud, right?
When
he came to the kinetic North America, that's when the kinetic twitch came out of him. And he got really focused on kinetic space, especially with the orgasm and the chemical body being obsolete. So therefore, it archetypalized the body processes, which is what he's about. And that's what McLuhan said. His own book, Understanding Media, was based on speech as an archetype.
Right. And with Reich coming to America, especially with a switch from, because, I mean, he was already pretty focused on a sex economy, but that was a more psychological, economic, communistic theory, and then moving to America tended to represent the moving into a more lab-based biology and then physics applications rather than sociology, psychology applications.
Yeah, that's good.
It turns out there is one note about Reich in, because Burroughs mentions Reich frequently, and he was a big hero of his, and in Nova Express at one point he gives a very brief rundown that mentions Dr. Wilhelm Reich and the orgone, and McLuhan underlined Reich's name and underlined orgone and wrote EOM beside it. And then elsewhere on the back cover, he wrote orgone as EOM, and EOM is extension of man.
Right.
I was kind of expecting it to be a satellite paradigm thing, but to imply that the orgone is like a technology or an extension, that was I wasn't expecting that.
Yeah, and so I think that's a little odd that he's calling Reich's theory, whatever it is about the orgone, I haven't read much on it, but it's some kind of theory. And so McLuhan's saying, no, it's an extension, it's a medium. So I think that was McLuhan's critique, that Reich misses the material basis of his theory in technology. That may be what McLuhan was getting at, because that's a very general term, EON. That just might as well just say medium, you know, extension of man.
And it shows up all over the place. And
yeah.
I guess in it could have been more colored by the way Burroughs was describing it, as Wilhelm Reich has isolated or identified the basic unit of life. So could have had something to do with that, kind of like I found the life particle.
Right, or it's a pun by McLuhan, a joke, making the phallic nature of Reich's philosophy is EOM. McLuhan used to talk about the fly's penis as a probe. So it could be a bit of a joke that he's talking about the orgone as an extension of the phallus.
Yeah.
Okay, now I want to just continue the thing about, so, you know, you have tactility as a figure. So the string theory will get more and more tactile as figure as we move into the hidden ground, which is ionic figure physics. And what we're using to make our Coldplay and to make our products is the iCell, which you can see on our website, rnareset.com. So we are the ones providing the new technological ground, and probably me and whoever else are the only ones conceptualizing about it. You know, we're in the position of those quantum guys in 1927 in Copenhagen. No one even knows about that development, but the avant-garde thinkers are thinking about it. Well, I'm thinking up a new physics post-string theory with the knowledge from ion. That's what one of my hobbies are, is how to express it. And I find that Finnegan's Wake is really a great expression of the physics. I mean, Joyce is going to come into his own as his thesis is way better than Einstein's. You know, Finnegan's Wake is a correct way to present a paper on physics, not so equitone as Einstein's was.
Right. I mean, Einstein needs to use such a, you know, he's like, imagine being in in a train going through space or something. Like, he's got these very absurd, like, completely far removed thought experiments,
yeah.
Whereas Joyce in Finnegan's Wake, at least the idea of entanglement is very powerfully fleshed out.
And he's giving the ground. You know, you were pointing out how Newton was a product of the printing press and early industry, and would you say electric physics is Einstein? McClure said that Einstein was merely sculptural with E equals MC squared, which is tactile.
Mm.
But Joyce included the ground of his thinking about physics while writing about it. See, that's the better sophistication. Like if I held a press conference about my new physics, I'd have to talk about the media that was covering me as I was having my press conference. You see what I mean?
Right.
You have to include the ground.
You have to. Your only possible thought experiment that could resonate properly would be like, imagine you're listening to me describe the new physics.
And then I'd ask him to turn off the lights in the National Press Club, shut all the media off, and then say, okay, physics has changed. We now, under these conditions, have a different kind of physics. You know, illustrate the change.
We're huddled in a dark cave.
Yeah, dark matter.
Right.
You know, dark matter, dark energy is an expression of the post-tactile, post-information society. It's post-communication.
Mm-hmm. Actually, the communication aspect is very, you know, that's not just some baffle gab or something. It's like it's all about, like, whether how is this matter communicating with and affecting the rest of the matter. It doesn't do it the way we think it does.
Exactly. That's it.
Not doing it in a visually traceable way.
All right. Next thought you got.
Next thought. I haven't pulled out the Naked Lunch yet. There's a few Burroughs books. I wish there had been. It would be nice if there were annotations in. He's got The Third Mind there, the collaboration with Geisen, but there are no annotations in that. There's two Burroughs books with annotations. Nova Express, which I've pretty thoroughly looked at this point and talked about mostly. And then also Naked Lunch. And I haven't looked at Naked Lunch, the book, yet, but there was a handwritten note page removed from Naked Lunch. And so I looked at that, and there's a couple interesting things in there, actually, especially Ree Guffey's book. The last line on that page is scatology as synesthesia.
Mm.
So
that's Guffey?
Nice,
Guffey or Burroughs?
Oh, sorry. In McLuhan's page of handwritten notes that was tucked into Naked Lunch. So I mostly was looking at Nova Express before. I haven't looked at his annotations in the book of Naked Lunch, but I've looked at this one handwritten page that was tucked into Naked Lunch.
And that's his phrase.
Page.
That's McLuhan writing scatologia synesthesia. He's saying that. Yeah, most of the thoughts about Nova Express and Naked Lunch are in the review in Nation magazine in December 64. That's where he really makes his statement about those two books, right?
Right.
The famous review, December 64.
For sure.
Let's see.
And one of the interesting things he says in that review that's I think I recall somewhere Burroughs reacting to this, like, I don't really know what he means by that. I can't say that I agree, but where he says something about that psychedelics, you're consuming content, but junk is required to turn your body into an environment that includes
the universe. The whole universe. You put on the whole universe with junk, with heroin.
Yeah.
You don't do that
with
LSD.
One of the notes here seems pretty relevant to that, which is He says, Iago as work equals motiveless malignity, and then new mock, which I'm pretty sure means Machiavellian,
yeah.
But new Machiavellian mask of power via identification with nature, brackets, EOM of nervous system, Burroughs quite impersonal.
Yes. Now, the Iago is very important because that's the beginning of the private talent. The
right.
Individualism that begins with capitalism and the printing press, and so he's a very manipulative person, Iago. And
yeah.
What else did he say?
His malignity is not, it's motiveless. It's very, impersonal and can be applied to a task or something.
Right. It's also the resentment because when the printing press went around the world, it obsolesced nature and humans, McClone says. I mean, the horror that people think the matrix is going to do to them, you get rid of the human scale, happened 500 years ago with the printing press. And nature became the content, and humans became the content, and then eventually in the factories, processed in the factories. And then the big orgasm was the concentration camps and the ovens in Germany was the punchline to that process. But it goes back 400 or 500 years about nature. So what he just said there about nature, Iago is bitter. He represents the psychopath who's picking up on, it's like post-Armageddon, post-apocalypse. Humanity's been usurped by the printing press and the new exaggerated visual space, and people are bitter, and they can't have any framework, so they're motiveless. Motiveless malignity. That's Iago, and that's the Machiavellian design. The reason the kings had to go for Machiavelli is that the human scale was gone. You had to control the new capitalist economies with brute force. What was the guy, Thomas Hobbes, might is right. And
right.
Machiavelli says, you have to be impersonal. You have to make your decisions for state with no regard to any human scale values. You just have to be an agency of the new visually biased nature, which nature
right.
being the content. And so there's McClellan, if you understand that. He's being very precise. And then it's interesting, he says Burroughs is impersonal. Burroughs is still shocked by that. Burroughs is oscillating to the robotic reality that came in with the printing press, and he's complaining 500 years later. But he also can see the electronic effects are opening up something. And I don't think Burroughs is clear on it as McClellan. He's not, doesn't have the poise, which is what McClellan says in the Nation magazine thing, that Burroughs is still panicking, reacting, and not acting. But to act... act personally, which McLuhan would do in certain levels, even though he's very impersonal when he got with him privately, but he would pretend to be personal in public as an anti-environment to what people living in the rearview mirror thought was happening with the electric environment, a very cold world,
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was weaving in and out there. Did you follow that?
I'd say so. It definitely speaks to Burroughs's moral style and his particular type of moral outrage and
yeah.
his evil monstrous characters, the way that they are projected.
You mean like Dr. Benway?
Right.
Yeah. Dr. Benway.
That these villains in Burroughs are, well, I mean, this idea the new Machiavellian mask of power via identification with nature, extension of man of nervous system, that idea of once we've extended the nervous system that these Burroughs villains are they become more like they're human actors or quasi-human actors anyway of villains and Machiavellian power operators, but they also come across as basically gods of some kind or some kind of vast nature force, like they're
right.
as much face of a principle of evil as they are a person and a bad character.
Right.
And actually somewhere in the Burroughs Book of Letters I was reading, one of the parts that really struck out, I'm surprised more people haven't quoted this from Burroughs, saying, maybe just because this book only just came out, where he says to someone, all my books are actually children's books with mythological characters.
Yeah, and then McClellan would counter that with, well, everybody's gray at 3 now.
Right.
You know, so Burroughs thinks they're still children. McLuhan knew there weren't children anymore. Everybody was just 1 or 2 year old emotionally. In the global nursery, he talked about it. So it's very interesting to take what those guys say, what the writers of the day say, and then watch McLuhan fully aware of what they're saying, and he would shift the focus a little bit. And he actually turns out to be the most original and the most detached. And these notes you get in his book show that. You know, I mean, he's not being moralistic about Burroughs. He's saying, this is a new syndrome. I'm going to study this guy. I'm going to figure out the figure ground here. And that's what you see in these notes. He's looking at Burroughs and them clinically. He's actually being impersonal to Burroughs professionally. But he does it with a human scale, quote, optimistic, or there's a breakthrough from mechanization that the electric age is bringing in.
Right. Trying to, you know, probing around for a way to be humanistic.
Yeah. That's what he writes. It's very important. He writes in his letter to Harold Innes in March 1951, very important, long letter. Okay, he's now starting to engage and put on Innes. He's going to have to, you know, swallow him or do something. Innes would be dead within a year. But anyways, he tells
Innes.
It's going to
have to be an overwhelming barrage from the beginning.
Beg your pardon?
Yeah. Just saying, it's good. The initial assault is going to have to be overwhelming.
Yeah, it's like this University of Toronto campus ain't big enough for both of us. So, So he starts by offering a new team that he's inviting Innes to be part of, aware people. But he tells Lewis, now he tells Innes, and we don't know, or I don't think McLuhan knew, that Innes had gotten a lot from Wyndham Lewis. But because the way McLuhan is telling Innes, he's saying, as if he didn't think Innes would know this, he says, Wyndham Lewis, his Art of Being Ruled, which was about 1926, 1927, and this is 1951, many years later, he's saying, the Art of Being Ruled, that book is as monumental as Machiavelli's The Prince. And he sort of states the syndrome of the prince and how it had to respond to the robotization of humanity 400 or 500 years before. But he's saying the electric age is completely different, and Lewis shows the human scale in our technological monstrous landscape. He says it right there, that Lewis shows the human scale. And that's a major new flip of the Machiavellian tetrad management. So that's a really important, amazing statement by McLuhan to Innes, talking about the human scale in media. Whereas Innes was depressed and got cancer and could be dead in a year, you know?
Mm. Yeah, and it can definitely be hard to find the human scale in Burroughs.
Right.
At least, especially in the early Burroughs, and kind of the later Burroughs kind of ends up being this necessarily kind of somewhat doomed and romantic.
Looking for community and cults.
Yeah.
Yeah, looking for community and cults. And like Scientology and whatever other things he got interested in. I mean, he's hanging out with Ginsberg and them in the 80s. There's some interviews, and they're sitting around looking for community. It's an interesting interview or dialogue among them. And remember, they were at 22. His bunker was 22-something, whatever street it was in New York City.
Yeah, the Bowery or something.
Yeah, 22 Bowery. But and it's interesting, McLuhan privately would say, stay away from those guys. You know, you'll end up like, you end up like Debbie Harry and David Bowie, you know, all screwed over, diseased, because they hung out with Burroughs. They did not come to Toronto. It's very interesting that only Brian Eno came to Toronto and actually sat in.
Really?
He sat in on some of de Kerckhoff's courses, who I'm having dialogues with right now. De Kerckhoff was the head guy at the Cochos after McLuhan was gone. And he attracted some of these artist people, like Brian Eno, because I met a kid. One of the guys who worked on the video of Everything's Disappeared for Nelson Thal and Dave Neufeld, one of the guys downtown, technicians, art student, he attended some of de Kerckhoff's courses, and he told me that Eno was there, and some guys in CKL.
Well, that makes sense.
Does that make sense?
That makes sense to me. I mean, Eno is definitely, he came out of the kind of glam rock scene, but then
he was heading for Burroughs Bunker, but he turned left in Greenland and went to Toronto. he made a break.
Right. Well, yeah, I remember there was that other note I told you about on the phone, but not on the radio here, that was written in the back of Nova Express, and it kind of sounds like something Burroughs could maybe have said, but if it was, then there probably would have been a page number attribution to it. Mm-hmm. It seems like it's just a little thought that McLuhan had, that he said, if you're with it, you've had it.
That's right. Yeah, you go to New York, you've had it. New York was the wizard place.
You spend your time trying to be cool, you're lost.
Yeah, you're in big trouble. And most of the only guy in the American scene who did not try to be cool was Zappa. And he survived up to a point, and then he was murdered. He was too cool, too detached, so they killed him. But the all the other guys, they didn't get very healthy. Who's a healthy person today of the pop culture rock world? Who survived? Sting? Did Sting survive?
Sting's around. Well, I mean, Burroughs made it till 97, but I always found it funny that Burroughs outlasted pretty much everyone else of that generation. Some of them only by a year or so.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, yeah. they all died after I interacted with them in New York in the mid-90s. Ginsberg died 18 months. Even Zappa went 18 months after our major interview with him. But the when I was with Burroughs at the Ontario College of Art, and it would have been about 78 or 79, I'd keep track of the bulletin board that the art professors would bring in people. And you can listen to my interview dialogue with Dennis Young, which is up at FiveBody.com, who was Eminence Grease there and then in Halifax. And we talk a bit about these eras in the art colleges. But the one in Toronto, it brought in Burroughs. And I always remember I went down there. It was like a Friday afternoon in this small room with a couch, and Burroughs is slouched down, like so pissed off. I mean, he's supposed to be teaching the students, or, you know, he's been brought in as a guest, somebody, as an artist, and he's sitting there with his arms folded. I'm standing nearby. I'm just sort of interloping. I'm not a student officially, but luckily I knew he was there. And he's so frowning and so negative and dark, like a black hole. And he's just sitting there hardly saying anything. And then you think how McLuhan at least would walk around and have some vivacity to him, you know, and try to engage people. And
try to spark some sort of novel exchange or something.
I mean, I don't think it's good for a student to see a guy, I mean, unless he's following the path of negativity, and you must go into the depths of dark matter and get through it. So he was an example of that methodology. But when I spoke to him after, I said, I mentioned McLuhan because I wanted to talk about what he wrote about McLuhan in the LA Free Press about 1970. I'd always remembered it. He said McLuhan was a word analyst, which was a pretty good statement. And I had talked about this with McLuhan in 75. So here I am with Burroughs to report back what McLuhan said. So I mentioned McLuhan. He goes, oh, well, he's just up the street. Because the art college is just down from Queen's Park Crescent, where McLuhan's office was, right? And this would be maybe it was 76. McLuhan's there 76 to 79. He falls down in September 69, September 26th. Okay, so I'm with Burroughs in 78 probably. And he was fully aware where McLuhan was. You know, well, he's just up the street. And I said, why don't you visit him? And he just scowled. And then I said, well, here's what McLuhan said about you calling his work a word analyst, or word analysis. I said, McLuhan told me, well, on the streetcar, going up to his acupuncture person, who became a friend of Carolyn Slater, Don Gay, at 235 St. Clair Avenue West, which is right beside where Michael Blake Reed was doing the Evergreens. But I did not know that from 74 to 80. So right next door to the Evergreens, McLuhan was getting acupuncture in 75, and he says, well, if Burroughs said that, then that's accurate if you consider all media as the content of the word. Airplanes, bulldozers, and he lists off a bunch of inventions, technologies. If all that is the content of the word, then that's an accurate statement. So I tell this, this is how he took, I'm saying to Burroughs, this is how McLuhan took your statement, and he just sort of grumbled a little bit. See, he wasn't very communicative. He didn't care. The main thing he said to the students is, well, us gay guys, we got to form our own CIA. That was his agenda, was to form a CIA for the gay community, which it was just sort of surfacing in the late 70s in full force with the Village People and Studio 54 just before AIDS knocked them for a loop. But they were feeling their oats, and Burroughs said, okay, we got a nation here, gay nation, let's form our CIA.
Right.
So it's very...
Yeah, well, I mean, that's kind of interesting enough, but yeah, it seems like definitely I definitely feel what you're saying about Burroughs' kind of just non-committal response to the McLuhan thing there. Like,
yeah, they do not want a dialogue.
Distracted by other things. But, yeah, I was just thinking that probably the best answer to who's healthy, who was right in there with everything and not only made it out alive, but is still around and still vital and not just haplessly trying to, you know, evoke a replay of themselves back then, would be Neil Young.
Yeah.
And because he's still pretty vitally working on things these days. He's trying to get a whole new sound system going. He's trying to revolutionize digital music, for one thing. He's trying to work on the idea of be an influence on a post oil car situation. And I mean, I just saw him on TV recently, and it was like I saw Robert Plant on TV, and he very much seemed like, you know, he seemed fairly healthy or whatever, but he was pretty boring and silly, and his new music was boring and silly. Yeah. But then Neil Young, he just seemed much more alive and interesting, and I don't know, he's got like a couple new books out lately, and he's the Canadian guy.
That's
and everything.
The point.
So.
He's got the advantage of having come out of Canada.
Right.
The what is it? Everybody else is not a Canadian, and they all have dead in Burroughs' bunker. And they're the type, they're what McLuhan called Gnostic. They believed in the solitary mystical individual, and they would not talk. But Brian Eno sounds like a guy who would dialogue with anybody and showed up to actually listen to what McLuhan had to say. You know, that's a good posture to take. And that's always given me the advantage of everybody. I'll talk to anything that moves. And if you keep talking, you meet new people, and then that's fun. That's the disadvantage of being famous and be put into a bubble. It's a big disservice. You lose your ability to interact with the fresh new people. Like just you, meeting you, you know, was a nice experience for me to meet your generation and your buddies. And that's why McLuhan liked being a teacher. You would meet the young kids, you know, that's the whole point.
It's guaranteed to meet some new people that way that are not just people that you're meeting because they've been funneled to your celebrity. But
Yeah, and I made a lot of friends of a lot of different McLuhan students. You know, all of them are pretty interesting, the ones who got into McLuhan. Now, back to this thing. So, I can totally understand why McLuhan, he was not talking, it was not like a judgment of Burroughs' character. It was a judgment of the black hole of that scene. I mean, Ginsberg and his lover, Phil, forget his last name. That guy was always freaking out. You can go on YouTube. He's, you know, throwing stuff around in their apartments. They're always having disasters in their personal lives, different things. Maybe end up in jail for a while. Whereas McLuhan, here he was seeing through everything, and everything was pretty well dead. He used to say, is there life before death? But he could see his own faith somehow kept him going. But he could still function and be a normal, civilized person, ignoring the disaster around him. Whereas everybody else got screwed up with some movement and then got lost in their movement or bitter. And I would say Zappa was pretty good at, like McLuhan in that way. I mean, there's interview. People could end up at Zappa's home, his fans, and get to talk to him, get to be in it, do an interview if they had some media to do it. You know, anybody could get in there. They try to do that with John Lennon or Paul McCartney or anybody.
Well, that's definitely the opposite of kind of you know, the type of cliche kind of wisdom of celebrity. Being cool around celebrities or something is that, like, oh, please, like, the most gauche possible thing you could do is just be a fan and try to go interact with them.
Yeah. Yeah, you're not supposed to.
You're ever going to get to do that.
Well, I managed to get it done, but the problem with somebody who's a fan and thinks he has to be cool, that's you miss out on everything. You have to sort of appear knowing, well, with your God, with your hero. That's you missed it. I used to say stupid stuff. I mean, I used to phone up Frank out of the blue, start saying interesting questions, and he would talk for a while, and then he'd say, "That's enough out of you, buddy." and he stopped. And then one time I called up with a fake voice, and this was in 78, and I got a few questions in. And then that was that. And then I was backstage the next night and talking to his musicians, Tommy Mars and Ed Mann and these guys that were just starting out the late 70s. And after everybody left, it was just me and Frank there, and I was eating the grapes nut on the table in the buffet, and it was just him and me. And, of course, we knew each other, but he wasn't saying anything. And so then I started to ask him something. He says, Bob, you were the guy who phoned yesterday, and I'm not asking any more of your questions today. And so that was the end of that. He wouldn't talk, but he said, "I recognize your voice, you know, from the phone call, or how it had been distorted." But he caught me the next night. But we were by ourselves, so when he said that, I gave him a cold shoulder. I didn't say a word. I just kept eating the grapes, and he sat there. So we're both quietly eating the buffet, refusing to talk to each other.
That's funny.
But then again, you know, a year later or two, I'd meet him somewhere, and then it'd be all forgotten. We'd start over, and that's when I got him interested in Larry Flynt, which led to Thing Fish, and then led to him being murdered because of what he was doing with Thing Fish. That's another story. But you can hear that on my dialogues with Ike Willis back in 2012. Ike Willis, December 2012, I'd say.
Those ones are on the Dobbstown.com.
Yes, is he listed in that? That's a good point. I know he's on the timeline. Let me just check that. Is he listed? Yes, he's listed there. Yes, they're all on Dobbstown.com. Gerd Stern came up. Don't know what it was, but those interviews I'm doing turning out to be pretty valuable. Gerd Stern's starting to get known by many generations because he's still alive. He's the Forrest Gump of so much, and he's still being asked to speak it all over the world at art schools. And so he had to upgrade his McLuhan knowledge because they're interested in that. And so I debriefed him on McLuhan a little bit, and I have to get in touch with him and correct him on some of the recent things he was saying to Harold Channer. But anyways, it's turning out I picked the right people to interview.
Yeah.
And they would, you know, go ahead. What were we going to say?
Oh, I was going to kind of change the subject a bit, but if you got something, just that it's something that came up before when I very first mentioned Burroughs and reading this new book of letters, and you asked about what he says about McLuhan, and there's a few mentions of McLuhan in there, but nothing really of an in-depth response. But what I did find interesting was that pretty much probably arguably the best segment, the best sequence of the whole book is in this letter that comes right after he defends McLuhan to Geisen, or kind of being very more fair-minded about McLuhan. And I don't know, if you like, I'd love to share this bit of a letter.
Yeah.
It's a pretty long letter, but it gets very interesting.
So this is Burroughs defending McLuhan to Geisen, his partner.
It's a letter to Geisen near the end, December 23rd, 1966. And he says, ... a whole bunch of stuff beforehand. "And let me say further that I have never been able to understand your peculiar feeling about Catholics. It's something I've seen before in people who went to a Catholic school. I guess you have to experience it to know that priest stink gets into your bones. Breathe it so long you'll never be rid of it. Whimper for the priest when you're dying. You don't know how evil an old priest can be. The unforgivable sin is to be a Catholic, born knowing the unforgivable sin, apparent because we believe it. What I say is this: so long as a man acts like a friend, let's treat him that way. And then he says, Reverend Marshall McLuhan wrote one of the very few intelligent and appreciative reviews on Nova Express, and that Catholic reporter from España gave me one of the best and fairest interviews I've received in my literary career. So why does it nullify the value of McLuhan's work that he is a practicing Catholic? I guess that's what Geisen had said.
Right.
So that's, you know, it's good defense, and it's interesting that right after defending McLuhan, he then changes the subject into my favorite section in the whole book. Says, actually, can one trust a lapsed Catholic? Sure, we know how evil an old priest can be, or an old Jew, or an old woman, or an old white settler. You will learn to know when a friend has become an enemy in the area where people are urged to be watchful. Now
what's that? You will learn any when they're urgently watched? What did you say?
You will learn to know when a friend has become an enemy in the area where people are urged to be watchful.
Hmm.
And then now a few hints that may be of use to you in formulating they. The, like, capital T, they, in brackets, them. They are all the millions of fraudulent people. Where do they come from? Secondhand words, rags, and tatters of old film. They are L. Ron Hubbard, Mary, and John Cook the Beard. They are local fakers with superhuman pretensions based on a few simple tricks carefully concealed and monopolized. To the point, you start to get the feeling he's talking about UFOs.
Yeah.
Are local fakers with superhuman pretensions based on a few simple tricks carefully concealed and monopolized. They are not from another planet. They are not even agents of another planet. They did not come from space. They cannot live in space. If they were sufficiently advanced biologically and technically for space travel and flying saucers, they would have no need to guard so carefully a few old tricks with film and tape recorders. The last thing they want to see are actual landings of flying saucers. Tip. He kind of digresses a bit, saying some things about fucking L. Ron Hubbard stuff, and then the power of the beard is based on word lines, and of course also on the film. This is an actual film made around 1910 or 1912, when the potential of film as a central instrument first became apparent. The same film has been used ever since. Any control instrument loses its power when repeated. The first cut-ups, the first photo montages, as we know, had something that later cut-ups and montages did not have. You have seen some of the scenes from this film, Aztec temples, a number of fake scenes from other planets. Remember the blue magis that night in your room with Mosley? Just a piece of the film, not from Uranus or any extraterrestrial source, just old photographer tricks from an old local film. Given the equipment, anyone could do these things as easy as turning on a light. That is why they have given us so much trouble. They know that they are second-rate fakers, and if the tricks on which their power is based became generally known, other people will be able to do it and do it better. They are identified by their fear of the real thing, since their fraudulent identity is all they have. They are not cruel, super-intelligent beings. They are stupid, second-rate human characters. When the monopoly is broken, they will not be able to compete. And being able to do it and do it better gives one a chance to ask, why do it at all?
That's a tremendous statement. And I really like what he says about McLuhan. That's a fair statement. You know, if a person mm-hmm. is being a friend, doesn't matter what his category is, his label is, that's pretty good. He seemed to have pretty pure perceptions in that early years. You know, and he's not famous yet. You know, he's sort of known, but he doesn't really...
Yeah, he's notorious to a certain extent, but not an icon.
Yeah, like he's living in London in the mid-60s, and when he comes to New York in the early 70s, I think, that's when he became the Eminence Grease, and then people started hanging around him, and then he became a hero to the boomer artists and that. And then you have the famous Nova Convention of 1978. Right?
Mm.
And that's like the celebration of him. But it's interesting, you know, if you knew about him before then, you'd be surprised that he actually wasn't known till the late 70s, early 80s,
right.
The way that he became a big deal. Because the
yeah, well, yeah, I mean, his when people talk about, you know, they're like, oh, and his iconic book, Naked Lunch. It's like, well, when was that published? And it's like, yeah, but that's not when he exploded onto the scene.
And you know, that book, that was the book I saw on McLuhan's desk just before he had the stroke in the summer of 79. Is it called The Third Mind or the Red Cities? Is that two different books?
Yeah, there's The Cities of the Red Night is the first book of Burroughs' later trilogy, and that book in particular is probably his most straightforward prose book. But The Third Mind is a different book that he was a collaboration with Geisen.
Would they be out at the same time, the late 70s? Because I'm trying to remember which book I saw on the desk that McLuhan was looking at.
I think so. I think The Third Mind was late 70s. I think Cities of the Red Night, though, I think that was more 80s.
Oh, okay, so then it must have been Third Mind, because the word third sticks in my head. So
that one is on the list as being in the Fisher Library. It just doesn't have any annotations, unfortunately.
Right. He may have gotten it just before he went aphasic, you know, had a stroke mm-hmm. and couldn't read talkers or write. He didn't make it. But I don't know if he did the Burroughs in between books, but he was looking at Burroughs. That would be right when Burroughs was starting to become a figure, and that's probably why McLuhan, if he hadn't been looking at Burroughs, that's why he had to. Because Burroughs was back in a second wind for Burroughs.
Right.
Now, I got a whole bunch of people sitting here. Let's see if they have something
to say.
Let's see if they want to talk.
All participants are now unmuted.
Ask Brian about the topic or anything that's relevant to what we're talking about. Zion's not here at this point, but who would like to say something about what we're discussing?
Hey, Bob?
Yes.
It's Bart.
Okay, go ahead, Bart.
I wondered if you could speak more on the idea of the human scale and how that's been obsolesced, or how would you explain that?
Well, it begins with the analog electric systems, where anybody with an electric battery could have a home, a table, a crowd of people. Whereas before that, you had to be in the cities if you were going to have a cultural salon. And the decentralist nature, what McLuhan called C minus M, that center without margins or no boundaries and centers everywhere, as opposed to C/M, which is a bureaucratic center capital, and then everybody else is provincial if they're not in New York City or something. So the decentralizing of the gargantuan effect of the printing press and kinetic machinery for 400 years, what Orwell was worried about becoming even global, was toppled in many ways by the decentralized fact that you could have electric power any place in the world. He used to say, McLuhan said, any highway eatery would have New Yorker and these and that magazines and newspapers, and you can get them anywhere in the world. Why would you live in New York City? So the beginning of human scale is the amazing breakup of the trend of gargantuan centralized. Think of those scenes in Terry Gilliam's Brazil, right? I mean, everybody's stuck inside in THX 1138. George Lucas is saying everybody's inside a big concrete place. That is really rearview mirror. That's 19th century. That's not the human scale. And the shrinking of media, you get into the 50s and 60s where people have their own transistor radios or their own small TVs. They were not beholden to the broadcast rigidity of the 50s, 40s, and 30s. So that's what McLuhan saw. There was something that's going to go around the Big Brother scenario that is inherent in the decentralized nature of electric media. Would you agree with that, Brian, what I just said?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And it's especially so now with the electric thing getting more and more with that now any highway eatery can be the place from which anyone can upload the newest viral sensation video or something, whereas before you definitely had to be in New York or L.A. or something to be broadcasting powerful cultural means.
Yeah, a good example was college radio in the 80s, Bart. I mean, here, before Now, my first getting on the radio and being interviewed was October 1st, 1984. And it was something you didn't expect to experience. You know, you had to get on the major networks and you had to be invited and it was all controlled, you know, all through the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s. So here it is, 1984. I'm on there and I figure, well, maybe the only time. And so I spewed everything out in that. You can hear that in the timeline, October 1st, 1984. But the fact that this was a college station which was using the FM bandwidth, I think it was FM bandwidth, only 13 watts, but you could create your own space in a small city like Toronto and be called by 1989 the best radio station in Toronto, that's pretty incredible. And then it really became available throughout the 80s. So when I showed up, that was the beginning of you being able to get on the airwaves, and anybody could listen to you. That's a human scale. That's going around the Barbara Frums, the CBC, the Knowlton Nashes, and all the control. And the old radio environment was being fragmented and allowed for kids to get on there. That's a return to human scale.
Yeah, and you flipped the 1984 scenario there.
I flipped it? Yes, you mean when I was on the radio. Yes,
right.
I did do that. You can listen to what I said. I said stuff that I was on there as Bob Dobbs, and Bob Marshall was the person on the radio for the next 3 years. But when I got on 3 years later in 1987 with Mike Dyer, I just picked up with what I had said in 1984 and developed it. You know, I said it all in the 25 minutes I had in 1984. And it's pretty funny. And it's with Nelson Thal, whose family owned the Toronto Star, which is one of the old major 1984 media, and James Kidney, who ends up being my, quote, enemy in the last episode of Fringe. See, that's the great synchrony there. That's who I did my first media thing. And we visited a friend of James Kidney's after, and he said, "Holy shit, how did you guys get on the radio? How did you get to say all that?" He was shocked. And this was an artist. People did not really see the decentralized effect of electric media. They just saw the content, which was the same people hogging the media forever and ever. Larry Zolf and As It Happens and all these old media in Canada. So you get the point here?
Yeah, you flipped the Orwell scenario. That's pretty funny. You actually came in and dismantled it or dissipated it, or however you want to say it. Yep.
Yeah, I didn't realize that I was doing it. I just took advantage of being on there. But a few years later, I realized what was going on. But I was not fully aware of Zinocrony at that when I first got on. I mean, basically, I was hiding. I had Bob Marshall do all the news stuff, and I kept in the background because I still was in the Secret Council 10 and had not even become chairman of it yet. So it was all pretty sneaky, and it's pretty amazing. 10 years later, it's an internet world, and everything is completely kaput. Yeah, all the old bugaboos, even Burroughs and them, don't have any enemies anymore on that level. And only McLuhan was the only guy to predict this breakthrough. Do you get what I'm saying, Brian?
Oh, yeah.
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 And you're saying
hey, Brian, even you got to be on a record, put a record out, right? Flowers of Hell.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, everyone's got a record out now. And it all came to me, too, basically. It's not...
Yeah.
I mean, to me, that's what stands out more. It didn't involve any kind of, you know, the putting yourself out there or something like you'd think in any sense more than meeting a guy at a party who, hey, join the band, and sure, I can play that, and that sounds good, and then boom, now come out with some few albums, and I'm in print that way.
Right, and I'd say that Burroughs, none of those guys understood that. Understood the total decentralist effect. As a matter of fact, if they did crack up in the late 80s and early 90s, Ginsburg, that's because the decentralist factor that McLuhan predicted was thrown for a loop.
Well, it's especially funny that people around that time were freaking out about the age of Aquarius and what that meant and stuff, because in terms of an example of the meaning of human scale, the best example I know of is one that you told me when I first came and met you in New York almost exactly 12 years ago was very simply described the meaning of that was just that you said in the age of Pisces, all media were extensions of water, and that McLuhan describes us swimming around in our media environments and that the media environment is imperceptible like water is to a fish, and the media environments were all huge. Whereas these days, you know, now the media has shrunk to being the water that we carry around in our hands.
Yeah, liquid
instead of
capital.
Excited, now we carry it, and that was long before it became very explicit. You know, when you were saying that to me, that was quite a few years before it became explicitly that everyone is walking around with all the world's media in their hand and their phone.
Their little goldfish bowl. Everybody had their little goldfish bowl. Everything was transparent. So, now,
It's me. I just want to clarify the one point. Are you saying human scale was retrieved or it was obsolesced?
No, it was retrieved by electric media.
Yeah.
And then the digital android, that's the whole modus operandi seduction, the android meme, is to make the world, make you bigger than media, bigger than anything. That's what the android meme more and more does to you. It disappears and makes you think you're in charge of your MySpace, Facebook, all your media layout. The android meme has done that. That's the second phase. The human scale was intimated in the analog media phase. That's McLuhan is the theorist of that. And then the Android meme phase is me and Croker talking about the seduction and making you, human scale is not even an issue. It's what would you call it? It's like now retrieval of God scale. You are a god, any little kid, god or goddess, you know, huge. And that's why I find Ion's metaphysics are right up with that, and he mirrors that. But here's a good example. Who was the goddess of this Burroughs, Talking Heads, David Bowie, CBGB's scene in the 70s? It was Patti Smith, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I've encountered Patti Smith several times in New York, other than the first time in April 75 when she did a really good run at CBGB's, and I think Dylan came out and hugged her or something. But that's when I told her to talk about Finney's Wake, and then she incorporated into the second set that night. And so through the years, I would always encounter Patti Smith here and there, maybe some gallery or something. And I start talking to her, and she always get paranoid about me after a while, and even though she didn't know me. So I had several paranoid realities with her. And as she got more obsolesced and lost and poor, and her husband was died, and all this stuff. She ends up back in New York, and maybe 2008, I'm at the Barnes & Noble for a Ralph Nader talk, and I'd heard, I knew that she supported Ralph Nader. Well, all of a sudden, I'm standing in the crowd at the back of the auditorium, and there's Patti Smith standing beside me with her poverty garb on, you know, her thing over her head, the toque over her head and a gray coat or something, and she's looking like tearful as Ralph Nader talks about these ridiculous fairy tale themes of his. He had a little book about the great themes of American democracy. It's just total nostalgia. And after a while, she's standing there. I lean over and I said, Ralph needs a little more McLuhan. I whisper that into her ear, and she looks at me. She probably recognized me. And once again, there's that snort with the snort from Sheboygan, the R. Crumb term. What was that? The nerd from Sheboygan. And anyways, so I just look back at Ralph Nader. Then I look back at her, and she's gone. She took off immediately. Now, my point is that's where you end up. If you avoid the McLuhan point, you end up isolated, running around with some old version of human scale desire, a human scale that is identified with the hippies, some kind of chemical body. Let's get back and stop the wars and arrest the drug dealers that are running the politics. So she's just in this forlorn position. And so this comes to Sandy Pearlman, who is your next assignment, Brian. When Sandy Pearlman speaks at the coach house, which he's due to do at some point, he's a guy who he's a McLuhan expert now. This is the guy who started Blue Oyster Cult. Look him up, P-E-A-R-L-M-A-N, Sandy Pearlman. He's like the new Lester Bangs of rock criticism because of his eminence greed, and he knew everybody. He promoted everybody, Clash, he managed everybody. He's now running around as a McLuhan expert, and he celebrates Patti Smith. He got Patti Smith recommended into the Library of Congress. You can see an interview with him about that. So he's running around hoiking up the old hippie archetypes or the Burroughs-Ginsburg myth and ignoring Frank Zappa and McLuhan. Yet he's speaking in the McLuhan context. And your assignment, Brian, is to get there and be friendly and get Richard Meltzer's email from Sandy, because we have to inform Richard Meltzer before he dies about what me and the Scott Woods did with Meltzer's stuff. But Sandy knows Meltzer, and that's the way. That's your assignment. But you can also go in and see what he has to say. You ever heard of him, Sandy Pearlman?
Sandy Pearlman, it's vaguely familiar. I mean, maybe in the context of Blue Oyster Cult or something. Maybe I heard his name peripherally with some McLuhan thing, but no, not really.
I mean, he gets to teach at McGill. He gets to teach at major universities. And here's his Xenocrity, close Xenocrity. When I was in California a month ago, up and down doing stuff, private business, I had to go to the San Jose airport, and I had to get a cab from way up north all the way down to San Jose. So we're zooming along, and what was good about the cab driver pointed at all the buildings of Facebook and Google and Microsoft, you know, through Silicon Valley. So we're coming to San Jose. All of a sudden I see it says Dominican University or something like that. I go, that's where Sandy Pearlman is. So I tell the cab driver, hey, hold it, take a right. So we go over into the Dominican University small campus, and I run into the administration building to see if Sandy Pearlman was teaching there then, because he was there 6 months before. So I finally got somebody, checked out he was not listed, so Sandy Pearlman was not there. But it was so close. I mean, it's just, I didn't know where Dominican University was, but I knew that Pearlman had taught there, wherever it was, and I drove right into it on the way to San Jose. So it was a nice, close call. And but I guess I meant to connect another way, but that was a nice little experience of Bob Luck. I mean, you know, just driving along, observing, and then there's the university where Mr. Pearlman, the man of the hour I'm trying to get to, is sitting there. But he wasn't.
Right.
But it was close, very close.
It kind of comes to you,
Yes. Yeah, it finds me. So let's see. Anybody have some, Roxanne, you must have some hip Berlin post David Bowie questions for this Burroughs guy that Brian's talking about. You got anything to say? No, didn't have anything to say. Anybody else? Now, don't be deadheads. You know, come on, make up shit.
Anything at all.
Yeah.
All right, I'll ask Brian, do you think Burroughs was actually talking about aliens? I wasn't clear on what you were reading there.
Well, he seemed to be trying to disabuse Dyson of the notion that the UFO phenomenon was aliens, and seemed to be trying to say, like, no, this is humans playing tricks, or either playing optical tricks of some kind, or, you know, secret aeronautic technology or something. But the gist I got from that is that, maybe he was talking both about UFO sightings and kind of the alien channelings, or like the entire extraterrestrial contact paradigm, but he seemed to be trying to convey the notion that, like, no, there's no, this isn't aliens, and these beings are not super intelligent, cruel from extraterrestrials. They're just humans playing God. Like,
right. They're your neighbor.
Your neighbor putting on a scary mask.
Right. And some famous artist said the real enemy is the guy next door who tends his garden and mows his lawn, and you just say hello to him every now and then. That was the real enemy.
Wyndham Lewis.
What?
Wyndham Lewis said that, didn't he?
Oh, that's, yeah, you're right, yeah. So the thing about Burroughs, Bart, is a lot of the world you were into before you met Ion, the UFO world and all that, a lot of those memes – were looked into by Burroughs. He actually was a prefiguring of the counterculture, which then became, for Generation X, like an average, you know, I guess, fringe interest in fringe topics. Burroughs was into all that stuff way ahead before anybody else, and would think about it and talk about it. And there he is talking about the UFO meme. And he was into Wilhelm Reich, you know. That was like, what would that be? That'd be like the May Brussels of his era, you know, some guy that the government put in jail and no one knew about it. Nobody, unless you were an informed citizen in some way like Burroughs, and interested, you wouldn't know about it. You just wouldn't, it wouldn't be on your radar. You'd just be reading Time magazine. So the issues that...
And Burroughs was into, like, right near the end of this book of letters. These letters go up to 1974. Near the end of it, there's a few letters where he's recommending Robert Monroe's Journeys Out of the Body.
Yeah,
saying,
right.
I've been trying some of these exercises, and you should really check this stuff out. And
that's the famous Monroe Institute.
Right. Yeah,
were those
Burroughs was
in the late 70s?
His early 70s.
Early 70s, yeah.
Now, this is 1974.
So he was into looking into any kind of fringe topic and what could be good about it. I mean, especially with the Scientology, knowing that there was some power to Scientology's methods, but really despising what L. Ron Hubbard ended up, the kind of tawdry personality cult he ended up building out of it.
Right. There's a movie. You've ever seen – let me say this part. You've seen that – film made in the early 30s, early 60s, where they have this, you know, crummy guys are at the head of the board, and all of a sudden these laser beams zap them and they're disappeared, and then another bunch of guys are sitting at the head of the board. You ever seen that little movie that Burroughs made with probably Geisen? You haven't seen it?
I have not.
I have one.
Yeah, you've seen it. The point is, there's a scenario of extraterrestrial forces or some very advanced laser beam people taking over corporations, like, you know, in the movie The Man Who Fell to Earth. He was very aware of Dr. Beter scenarios very early in late 50s, early 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And did he find his information mostly from reading books, or did he have contacts in the intelligence communities?
Well, I think that these guys, you know, Ginsburg and these guys would talk about, you know, National Enquirer kind of phenomenon in their day. They were like McLuhan. They would look at the ugly media, what academics wouldn't look at. They being street poets, street hustlers, street living, they were into what the population or the extreme part of the population was into, and they were up on it, and they'd investigate it. I mean, he's into Scientology. Who was doing that in 1960?
And being hip about it.
Yeah. And thinking about it and forming a position about it. You know, it was part of his morality or his ethics to understand these new phenomena. And then that's exactly what we did on Secret Council 10. We just went around and looked at the latest new phenomena. And so Burroughs was acting that out. He was acting out what an intelligent person should be doing.
Right.
Just that he didn't have the detachment McLuhan had.